harvest of the children of Woden was consumed in the conquest of Hampshire and the Isle of Wight, and the loss which he sustained in the Battle of Mount Baden reduced him to a state of inglorious repose. Kenric, his valiant son, advanced into Wiltshire, besieged Salisbury, at that time seated on a commanding eminence, and vanquished an army which advanced to the relief of the city. In the subsequent Battle of Marlborough, his British enemies displayed their military science. Their troops were formed in three lines. Each line consisted of three distinct bodies, and the cavalry, the archers, and the pikemen were distributed according to the principles of Roman tactics. The Saxons charged in one weighty column, boldly encountered with their short swords the long lances of the Britons, and maintained an equal conflict till the approach of night. Two decisive victories, the death of three British kings, and the reduction of Cirencester to Bath and Gloucester, established the fame and power of Ceolwin, the grandson of Cerdic, who carried his victorious arms to the banks of the Severn. After a war of 100 years, the independent Britons still occupied the whole extent of the western coast, from the wall of Antoninus to the extreme promontory of Cornwall, and the principal cities of the inland country still opposed the arms of the barbarians. Resistance became more languid as the number and boldness of the assailants continually increased. Winning their way by slow and painful efforts, the Saxons, the Angles, and their various confederates advanced from the north, from the east, and from the south, till their victorious banners were united in the centre of the island. Beyond the Severn, the Britons still asserted their national freedom, which survived the heptarchy and even the monarchy of the Saxons. The bravest warriors, who preferred exile to slavery, found a secure refuge in the mountains of Wales. The reluctant submission of Cornwall was delayed for some ages, and a band of fugitives acquired a settlement in Gaul by their own valour or the liberality of the Merovingian kings. But every British name is effaced by the illustrious name of Arthur, the hereditary prince of the Silures in South Wales, and the elective king or general of the nation. According to the most rational account, he defeated in 12 successive battles the Angles of the north and the Saxons of the west. But the declining age of the hero was embittered by popular ingratitude and domestic misfortunes. The events of his life are less interesting than the singular revolutions of his fame. During a period of 500 years, the tradition of his exploits was preserved and rudely embellished by the obscure bards of Wales and Armorica, who were odious to the Saxons and unknown to the rest of mankind. The pride and curiosity of the Norman conquerors prompted them to inquire into the ancient history of Britain. They listened with fond credulity to the tale of Arthur, and eagerly applauded the merit of a prince who had triumphed over the Saxons, their common enemies. His romance, transcribed in the Latin of Geoffrey of Monmouth, and afterwards translated into the fashionable idiom of the times, was enriched with the various, though incoherent, ornaments which were familiar to the experience, the learning, or the fancy of the 12th century. The progress of a Phrygian colony from the Tiber to the Thames was easily engrafted on the fable of the Aeneid, and the royal ancestors of Arthur derived their origin from Troy and claimed their alliance with the Caesars. His trophies were decorated with captive provinces and imperial titles, and his Danish victories avenged the recent injuries of his country. The gallantry and superstition of the British hero, his feasts and tournaments, and the memorable institution of his Knights of the Round Table were faithfully copied from the reigning manners of chivalry, and the fabulous exploits of Uther's son appear less incredible than the adventures which were achieved by the enterprising valour of the Normans. Pilgrimage and the Holy Wars introduced into Europe the specious miracles of Arabian magic. Fairies and giants, flying dragons and enchanted palaces were blended with the more simple fictions of the West, and the fate of Britain depended on the art or the predictions of Merlin. Every nation embraced and adorned the popular romance of Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. Their names were celebrated in Greece and Italy, and the voluminous tales of Sir Lancelot and Sir Tristram were devoutly studied by the princes and nobles who disregarded the genuine heroes and historians of antiquity. At length the light of science and reason was rekindled. The talisman was broken. The visionary fabric melted into air.